Today's program has been brought to you by Underground Meats, an American producer of handcrafted salami and cured meats in Madison, Wisconsin. For more information, visit shop.undergroundfoodcollective.org or stop by their butcher shop in Madison, Wisconsin. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning and welcome to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, and every Wednesday at 11 o'clock, we talk about taste. Today, actually, we're talking about taste, but we're going to be talking about cooking because we have everybody's favorite cooking expert, well, and cocktail expert. There's so many things we're going to be talking about today. Dave Arnold, welcome to the studio you're usually sitting on the other side of.
Oh, yeah. Well, hey, thanks for having me. It's good to be on somebody else's show. It's nice.
The responsibility is all mine. So Dave Arnold, who is host of Cooking Issues, which if you're a Heritage Radio listener, I'm sure you're a fan of, but also owner and chief mixologist, CMM, of nice. Booker & Dex in the East Village. Welcome. I want to ask you a question right off the bat that I think that has been on my mind lately, and you know, with apologies to Claude Levi-Strauss and all that. What is cooking?
Well, I mean, I think that's it's interesting. I mean, rather, it's something, yeah, that you used to read a lot about, like the raw and the cooked and whatnot. But I mean, so many people now consider themselves cooks, even if they actually are part of the raw movement, not
right.
doing any cooking at all. You know, I think we've branched away mentally from the, you know, the kind of the primitive dichotomous notion of something is either raw and unfutzed with, shall we say,
right.
or cooked and prepared. I think cooking really now, unless you're technically speaking about is it cooked, meaning have you killed all the bacteria or have uh-huh. you made it not pink anymore when you're talking about meats or have you made the vegetables soft, I think cooking as a kind of craft and profession is just more about manipulation and knowledge and having control over your ingredients.
Control. I like that. So there's a power thing going on.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, one, you are a master of so many things, including science in the kitchen and science in the cocktail bar, cocktail environment, and the idea of manipulating things. What is it? Why are we so fascinated, I do think, by cooking in this broadest sense of this manipulation, this power dynamic these days? I mean, it seems you can't, I mean, forget the celebrity of chefs, but just the notion of cooking, of transformation you talked about is just pervasive. People love the idea.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's, you know, there's several levels that we're kind of fascinated with it. I mean, I think in general, people who don't actually make anything, cooking, you know, or otherwise, enjoy seeing other people
right.
do it somehow, which is, I kind of get, but it's not really it's not my entree into the field.
You're not a performer, that you don't see yourself as a performer?
Or no, I don't see myself as a voyeur, really.
Right.
I don't really,
right.
yeah, I mean, I actually, you know, I used to do performance art. I mean,
oh.
I like performance. I like watching other people cook because I can really learn what's going on. But there's a whole group of people who are completely fascinated with it, just, you know, in the way that, you know, I'm fascinated by watching, you know, astronauts take off in rockets because you're
right.
like, holy crap, I can't believe
it's like
that.
Like magic.
Person. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Right. And then there's a whole group of people who enjoy transforming things, maybe do or don't get to do it in their daily life for work, but then, you know, they get to do it at home. And so they have a level of exploration that's open to them several times a day where they can become really, really nuanced. I mean, there's a lot of there's a lot of kind of mental therapy in just focusing on what you're doing and, you know, focusing on what can be done and finding differences between different things that you can do or different things you can buy that I think really intrigues people now, because it's it's once you get bitten by the bug of caring about what you make or caring about what you buy. From a food standpoint, it's just it just keeps enriching you on and on. It's not, you never really hit a wall,
right? Oh, interesting. You never hit a wall. Is that that's interesting, because in some ways in restaurants, which obviously are a certain form of cooking, it seems like if you may not hit a wall, but chefs get bored, diners get bored, they want something else. Suddenly, people are using liquid nitrogen that they didn't use before. Is that to get through a wall, or is it adding to the experience on both sides, the eating, the cooking, the doing, the entertaining of food?
Well, on a professional level, in kind of any pursuit, really, people who are making a living at something, there are inherent problems. So, you become known for a certain thing,
right.
Certain things are expected of you. And so it's the very rare person who can continue to be professionally fruitful for a long
right.
time. And I think it's really because it's extremely easy to get into a rut. Once you're doing something professionally, you have to have a certain level of consistency. It's a different kind of a game, and there's also much larger risks to going an entirely different direction when you're doing it as a professional.
Right.
So I think I think, a lot of people, when you're growing up, they're like, everyone does their best work when they're in their 20s or they're in their 30s. You know what I mean? But I think really a lot of it is not somebody's age. It's most people do their best work when they're young to a subject.
Mm.
And I think it's just because of that reason. It's that they get into a rut. And it's hard for them to punch out.
Right.
Certain things are a young person's game because, physically, I guess we deteriorate. Mentally, I guess we deteriorate somewhat, but I think it's really about freshness to a given subject. But you have people that keep on learning and growing, and those are the people that stay productive their whole lives.
Huh. So you've been a huge part of that. That learning, that it's that spark of learning in food. I mean, your work at the French Culinary Institute, and now one of the sponsors of the station, I should say, and another host, Dorothy Hegan Hamilton. You helped inspire, I think, people look at food in a different way, cooking in a different way. Can you talk about that experience? I mean, what engaged you in that pursuit?
I mean. My first professional food job, I was actually, wrote a little bit for Food Arts initially.
Right.
But my first professional food job was teaching kind of new technical forms of cooking to people at the French Culinary Institute. And, it was a very interesting time back in whatever it was, 05 or something like that.
They ate then?
People ate in 2005? No, but back then, there was a lot of people who were interested in the subject, but it was still relatively nascent. There weren't a lot of people in it, and there wasn't...
Especially here in the States, I think, more
yeah,
than anywhere,
I mean,
yeah.
Spain had its explosion, right. several years probably beforehand. And there were, WD-50 had just opened, within a year or two before that, I think, or three. No, maybe four. I mean, he'd been open a while. I'd known him since... fairly soon after he had opened.
He is Wiley Dufresne.
Yeah, Wiley Dufresne. Now my brother-in-law. there weren't that many people teaching it. There weren't as many blogs kind of devoted to
right.
it. I mean, Ideas and Food was around. But I think there was a real need for that, and the French Culinary recognized that this, in order to stay at the top of the game, this is a subject they needed to get interested in. And for me... it was a great time because there was so much really low hanging fruit that hadn't been explored. it was crazy. It was like a mad rush. It's people would just look at inventories of laboratory equipment and be, I don't know, will that work? I don't know that, and get a hold of it and start messing around with it. So it was a very interesting time. I think it's a much more mature time now for people who practice that sort of thing, and what's more gratifying is that the techniques that you know are associated with kind of that cadre of chefs has become extremely widespread in what you know most people think of as normal cooking.
Right. So normal cooking in quotes. You can't see the quotes you just made, but I mean you could put molecular gastronomy, which is what we're talking about. I mean at least the name that's stuck, even though everyone hates that name.
Everybody hates the name except Hervé Thys,
right, who coined the term. In fact, it's funny. I was with a scientist once watching a presentation by Hervé Thys, and it just made me think when you said there was a lab of equipment and people were just like, what do we do with this, that my science friend said to me, this is not science. This is playing with science. Do you ever thought about that?
Well, it's not so much playing with science as playing with scientific equipment.
Okay. Yeah. All right, I'll give you that.
Yeah,
guys and their toys.
Yeah,
gadgets.
Or yeah. I mean, the interesting thing. I mean, and come back to that later. The whole guy thing, because I think that's interesting, and it's been kind of painted as a man's movement in some way, which I think is not accurate. I mean, it's unfortunately accurate in the terms of people who become famous for doing it. But
that's true of cooking almost in general. That's a whole other topic.
Exactly. Yeah. Someone said, is this movement, is this movement somehow gendered? And I said, no, unfortunately, professional cooking as a whole is still gendered. It's still more difficult for, a competent woman, I think, to get to the very top of the profession than it is man, which sucks. And hopefully that will change and hopefully is changing. I mean, in my experience as a teacher, I will tell you that I saw an equal number of qualified men and women coming through the program with capabilities with equipment. I mean, right. It should be completely engendered. That's my opinion.
You won't go where Sumner's went and said that women can't do science or cooking cooking.
No, it's the same old thing. Like, everyone who's in something that used to be, a lot of things would be like, women can't be funny. Not true. What I mean? Many funny women, right. A lot of it goes back to, very hardcore centuries old, sexist beliefs about kind of the nature of the woman versus the nature of the man.
Sure.
But in fact, my experience has been that women can cook every bit as well and can set an immersion circulator every bit as accurately as any man I've ever noticed. And they burn or freeze their skin at roughly the same rates.
They're human too.
Yes,
but there is this thing. I can't get Alice Waters and her serving a frog hollow peach on a plate out of my mind as not gendered, but certainly a statement about cooking from a different time, certainly, and things have moved on here, and even in California and San Francisco, finally things have moved on a little bit from the salad as the height of gastronomy, to the other extreme, which we're kind of talking about, the immersion circulators, the liquid nitrogen, all that sort of stuff. Is what's in the middle? I mean, what do you think we're working towards?
Yeah, I mean, hopefully we're all working towards the same basic goal, which is giving cooks what they need to become inspired to make the best food that they possibly can. So, Alice Waters, when she was doing that, what is that now? How long has that been
30
going?
35 years.
Yeah, something like that, right? And that was a statement that needed to be made.
Right.
I mean, period. I mean, like, no matter what you think of her now or her restaurant or the cooking, it doesn't matter. That was a statement that needed to be made.
Right. The peach heard around the world.
Yeah, exactly. Right? Ferran's initial explosion of creative genius, which isn't spherification because who cares? You know what I mean?
Although he'll always be remembered as liquid olive.
But. Right, or foams or whatever. You know, we've all used foams our whole life if you've ever had whipped cream or anything else that's foamed, a meringue, whatever. But his important, super important thing is looking outside of fine dining for the inspiration to, for the stuff he was doing in fine dining. And I think that was a statement that needed to be made, and we're still dealing with the reverberations of that to this day. Even people – you know, I think that kind of movement even helped people who are doing the foraging thing or whatever, because it was a very clear statement that you don't need to look to the grand tradition of French cuisine from Crème through Escoffier up to wherever you want to put it, point, whatever. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like that is amazing, but you don't need to look to that for your main inspiration. You know, it's good to have that training, but but there are other inspirations, and I think that was a statement that needed to be made. The stuff that's going on now. With people hyper-focused on local ingredients and historical ingredients, Sean Brock, Renny Redzepi, statements need to be made. And I think that the what's been interesting about all of this, including Alice Waters, and then further, let's bring the Food Network into it, mm-hmm. is that this group of people, along with the people that, presumably you and I grew up watching Julia Childs, right. or James Beard.
Right.
Yeah, which, I've read his pasta book, I don't know how many millions of times,
Right.
From them through to the Food Network, now it's acceptable for people that have other avenues in life to go into professional food. And so you're seeing a whole new group of people that otherwise wouldn't become professional cooks and who are interested in cooking. And I think that in large part is why the food thing is so awesome right now.
On that, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. We're talking to Dave Arnold, who is the co-owner and chef of Booker & Dax and host of Cooking Issues.
She's dancing by herself in a mother's summer dress.
You are listening to Boy Crazy by Cookies. Keep it locked here on Heritage Radio Network.
Welcome back to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, and we are talking to Dave Arnold. We are talking about cooking issues, but not really issues about cooking, really, but things about the concept of cooking, chef cooking. If you have any questions about what we're talking about, or maybe you'd rather we talk about something else and you really want to know what to do with that steak you're looking at or those potatoes on your counter, give us a call at Heritage Radio Network. Our number is, 718-497-2128, or you can email us at info@heritageradionetwork.org, or if you prefer to communicate in 140 character tweets, you can tweet us at Taste Matters HRN. I love the idea that thinking about these cooking issues, let's call them that, you have to take a broader perspective. I think one of the things, as you mentioned, the Food Network changed the access that people had to information about food and also the opportunities that people had. But so I think in some ways social media or the internet is also responsible for some of the hyper-enthusiasm about trends and the speed they're moving now. And I think that we forget sometimes that there were revolutions in food in France, let's say, the Nouvelle Cuisine, all those sorts of things, long before there was molecular gastronomy, but we might not have known about them, or certainly they didn't come to your phone when you were shopping or taking a call. Do you think there? Can you explain, talk a little bit about the internet and the community of cooks and cooking enthusiasts out there?
Sure. And, you know, just a note on Nouvelle Cuisine, you know, Michael Batterbury was one of my great mentors. He always used to bring that point up. You know, he's one of the founders of, along with his wife, of Food and Wine and also of Food Arts. Yeah, he used to always bring that up all the time. Look at how revolutionary Nouvelle Cuisine was. And yeah, right. That took place without the internet. However, that was a revolution that was initially at least confined to an area and a group of people, and it just had very far-ranging repercussions.
Right.
What is different about this internet era, and I don't think the particular explosion of new techniques and equipment could have happened without it, is that information is instantly available everywhere. And, the internet, like the best part about it and the worst part about it, is it allows any two knuckleheads anywhere in the world who share a similar interest to find each other. Right? And sometimes right. That's for good and right. Sometimes that's for ill. But, I think that I've long said that the most important cooking tool I have is the internet.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know anyone, as much as everyone, gripes about Wikipedia's accuracy, I don't know anyone who doesn't just go to Wikipedia
start
to get a
there.
Ballpark.
Of course. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Anyone who says otherwise is a liar.
Right.
I mean, when I was a kid and I wanted to learn something, you were limited to the information in your local library.
Right.
And then if you found a decent bibliographical information in your local library, you then had to travel to a major university or to a major city library. We're blessed in New York to have one of the greatest libraries on earth. But, I don't know if you've been recently. The main branch is still amazing, but what used to be kind of the working branch, Mid-Manhattan Library, is just a shell of what it once
right.
was, because the need isn't necessarily, unfortunately, because I am very, I have a
pro book.
Pro physical
right.
book. The need just isn't there as much anymore because the information is so much more available. So, you're tempted to be extremely jealous of the generation coming up right now who their entire lives they've had access to all this information. But I like to think that scrounging for information made us stronger. I don't know. Without this kind of current without this current availability of information, I doubt that things like immersion circulators would have spread so fast. And the rate at which techniques are developing far outstrips what is possible for a single group of chefs to do.
Right.
And so everyone who's in the business of using new techniques is building on techniques that other people have either come up with or are building on. And people will build on things simultaneously. And it's exponentially increased the rate at which new things can be developed.
Exciting.
Yeah.
I think it's neat. And what does that have to do? So what is the relationship between some of this world of the professional chef and the molecular gastronomist or the inquisitive chef and the home cook? Because it's one of the things that we keep hearing, no one's cooking anymore, although I don't totally believe that, but I certainly think that people are cooking in different ways, maybe. I mean, what can you take away from all of this for dinner tonight?
That's a really good question. I mean, I think when people I originally thought you were going to bring up kind of the old gripe, which is that people who are using these new technologies, they don't know how to cook anymore. They don't know, which I think has largely been people. I don't really hear that anymore.
Right.
I used to hear that using things like immersion circulators or sous vide and all this stuff kind of took the heart out of the cooking. But I don't really hear that anymore. Which I'm kind of glad. Because I think they realize that, to be a good cook, you still have to have good hands, good feeling for the ingredients, and a good palate. But you know, everyone, especially professional restaurant chefs, tend to denigrate people's cooking at home, and point to the fact that people cook less and less, and you know, how many New Yorkers do you know who, you know, their oven's another storage device, you know, which don't listen, people, don't store anything in your ovens, for Christ's sakes. It's just a bad precedent. Yes. But, you know, I think some people still do cook, and there's a group of people who are cooking. But it's just that people are so busy now. They're so busy. It's hard for people to cook. People
right.
need to learn, you know, people need to learn to cook, you know, quickly. Now that I have two kids, you know, my window of cooking is 15 minutes.
Right.
You know, Rachel Ray's old 30-minute meals are far too complicated for me to break out at home now before the kids have to go to bed.
Do you think there's an inherent value in knowing how to cook? Does it matter? I mean, I like to think it does, but... But maybe it doesn't. I don't know how to play baseball, and some people would think that matters.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, it seems like there's two different skills, and to me they're somewhat related. There's knowing how to cook and there's knowing how to eat, right?
And they're different. I do love that you think they're different. I do too.
Yeah, I mean, they are. I mean, for me, I guess even like someone who, you know, like let's say a reviewer or someone who takes eating seriously or is professional at it, someone who's a cook – We share some of the same traits in that it's very difficult for us just to eat for enjoyment. You eat analytically all the time, no matter where you are. You know, breaking down whatever is being served to you, how it was made, you know, what kind of mistakes were done. And then later, hopefully, you can get past that and just enjoy what you're doing. Man, I lost where I was. I lost where we were starting with.
Well, it's funny. I don't know why. I just thought about this experience this weekend. I was in Maine and at Beth's Farm Market, which is I don't even know where it is. Maybe in Wiscasset or something. It's strawberry season, and I was told I had to go have a strawberry shortcake there, and it was maybe one of the best things I've ever eaten in my life. And the people I was with thought I was kidding because I've eaten a lot of things in my life, and I wasn't kidding. Like there was something so profoundly delicious and satisfying about this, the perfect shortcake, the amazing flavor of the strawberries, and this whipped cream that they're famous for from whatever cows or whatever. And I did think to myself that everyone who wasn't noticing this around me wasn't eating properly. Like there is a function to paying attention to some notion of discernment or cooking that lately fascinates me because I feel like it's the diner's responsibility from in the context of the restaurant or the chef or whatever to step up a little and notice and pay attention. That's half the equation.
Yeah, I mean that's as someone who serves people, that's very interesting. And it is true, I get irritated when I'm a diner and you know I feel that someone has gone produced something great and people are just kind of, you know, hoovering it in. Although I'm accused of that because I eat extremely quickly, but I really pay attention to eat.
I do too.
Yeah, but people are like, he's an animal, he eats so quickly. But no, I mean, I'm seriously thinking about what I'm doing. And it is frustrating. And I think as a cook, you just have to accept the fact that a whole bunch of people – you know, just don't care. I like to think that if you were to, how many times have you heard this? Someone says, my palate's not really sophisticated. I don't really, you know, but my sincerest, deep seated hope is that if you were to serve them your sublime, strawberry shortcake and then the average run of the mill one with the really kind of overly dry, crappy shortcake, the strawberries that have been beaten to hell,
right. and the Ready Whip or something.
Yeah, yeah. That they would be like, oh.
Right. I believe that too. Are we fooling ourselves, I wonder? I don't think so.
I don't think so either. I mean, right. I think the majority of people, you know, it's like anything else. There are many things of which, you know, I'm not a connoisseur. And so, but, you know, you pick up anything that's quality, and if you look at it,
I know there's a difference.
The quality.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's interesting. Yeah. Well, lately, even from we've been doing at the Beard Foundation some food system work and all, you know, about change and better ingredients and environment, all this sort of stuff. And I've been feeling a little bit lately that we've progressed so far on the producer side, the chef, the artisans, the bakers, the people making things have advanced so far and so quickly that it's the lagging behind or the consumer a little bit in our environment right now. And I mean, I think it's a trajectory, and I think we ought to focus on developing some notion of discernment that is not about being a snob, which is the hard part.
Yeah.
There.
No, I mean, I think it's super important, especially in the social and political climate of the United States, to not have caring about your food be a liberal East Coast big city rich effete thing. I think more of that.
I like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, most other countries, you know, it's not considered. It's not considered only a rich person's game to care about what that you put in your mouth, mm-hmm. you know. And my favorite story when this really hit me in the face, and you know I've told this many times. Hopefully, you know, no one listening has heard it yet. But when Howard Dean, the governor of Vermont, was running for president before he had his ill-fated scream mm-hmm. on the campaign trail,
ruined his career. Right?
Yeah, You know, one of the ads against him that was, you know, put out by Republicans was take your and then it was just a litany of, you know, things that they were, you know, liberal East Coaster. Right. But you know what? It was all food. It was take your latte drinking, sushi eating, and just like, you know, all of these kind of food things. Back to Vermont, where you came from. Right. Not that I think of Vermont as a sushi capital by any stretch.
Right.
Yeah. But you know, but what really struck me was, I'm being told that for a large group of Americans, caring about the coffee that you drink makes you a bad person, makes you a liberal. You know, which to them, I guess, is a bad person. But in other words, to me, caring about this stuff is not a political.
Right.
It's not a political thing.
It's a human thing.
It's a human
right.
thing. And I think, you know, we need to get past that. You know, even Chirac in France cares about the coffee that he drinks. You
of
know?
Course, right.
I mean, to go way back.
Right,
you know,
right,
just,
right.
Yeah,
but way back into the right.
Yeah.
Well, so, and that, ladies and gentlemen, is why taste matters. That's why you're listening, and that's why you are members, I hope, of Heritage Radio Network, and why you will tune in to Dave's podcast on cooking issues, and why we hope to have you here next week when we talk to Daniel Rose, speaking of France, who's an American chef cooking in Paris, and we were on location with him in a cafe and in a market in Paris, so that's going to be a great episode. Thank you, Dave, for being here on my show. Look forward to listening to more of you.
Oh, great. Thank you.
And folks at home, remember that taste matters. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website, or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.